The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's
the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, Space Show listeners, and welcome to our Friday morning California time Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. Let's run through the announcements so we can get into our program today. For those of you who are able to give us a call and want to use the phones today, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. You can also do email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and you can also post comments or ask a question via the Space Show blog for this program. So again, go to our website, thespaceshow.com. On the far right is the upcoming show menu. This is the first show listed. That is the archive page for this show. So if you open it up, comments and questions are available down at the bottom, as always. And you do not have to be logged in or registered to post a comment. You can do so as a guest. And when you do that, we will get your comment or question right away, and I'll be able to bring that up on the air as well. So those are the three ways you can communicate with us today. And, excuse me, do visit that website, thespaceshow.com. So we do have a very detailed website newsletter there that also has all of the schedule for the upcoming weeks. We're booking into second quarter of 2017. So not only do you see what's planned for the week in detail, you see who's scheduled in the upcoming weeks ahead. So do check out the website newsletter. Remember, everything we do is archived. You can either download the programs very, very quickly, or you can easily listen to them right off of our website. There is a store for you to get Space Show t-shirts and logo wear, hats, things of that nature, coffee mugs. So that is in the upper left menu under support, and you'll see our store. And there also is a menu item in the same area called Listen Live. And these are the instructions for listening to either a live or an archived show. Please feel free to share it with people you believe would be interested or should be interested in listening to Space Show programs. To me, the most important buttons and items on the website are the Support the Space Show buttons that can go over to the far right, and you will see them. So remember, the Space Show is a nonprofit 501c3, and the parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And the Space Show is able to do these programs and bring them to you free of charge because many of you do financially support the Space Show. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. And if you're a California taxpayer, you also get a tax deduction in California, as we are what's known as a public benefit corporation here in California. Again, the parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. If you have any questions, you want further information about our 501c3 status or tax deductions or anything like that, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We do have company sponsors, as well as many of you who individually support us. We could not be doing the show without our company sponsors, so we're deeply appreciative of them. They have banner ads running across our homepage, and I do urge you to check those ads from time to time and see what the sponsors are doing and, you know, what they say about themselves, what they offer. For the first segment today, we're putting two sponsors in for supporting us. So one of them is Celestis, and remember, they are the pioneer global leader in providing Memorial spaceflight services. They've been doing this since 1995. They have a new flight coming up the Celestis Lunar Memorial spaceflight, and they are taking reservations for this. This is a second Lunar Memorial spaceflight where they will fly people's cremated remains or their DNA to the moon. Moon Express, one of the contestants in the Google Lunar X Prize contest, will host the lunar mission, the Celestis lunar mission, and they are scheduled to launch sometime in the fourth quarter of 2017, before the end of the year. Last year, the government approved the MoonX mission to the moon, and just a few weeks ago, MoonX announced it had secured funding for the flight, so the ingredients are coming together for the second Celestis flight to our nearest celestial neighbor. The moon is a uniquely compelling location to remember a special life, and with the Celestis DNA service, you can also fly your own DNA there as well, along with the remains of your loved one. Join families from around the world later this year at Cape Canaveral, Florida, and also from the launch site in New Zealand for this ultimate mission. Celestis is the only company on the planet to have successfully conducted Memorial spaceflight. Their website is celestis.com, where you can make reservations and get lots more information. And as I say, I am their customer, and I love the company and feel it's probably one of the finest businesses I've ever done business with in my entire life. AIAA is another of our sponsors for the first segment. This is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, and they have what are called five annual forums, which are really conferences: SciTech, Defense, Aviation, Propulsion and Energy, and their big space conference, which this year is going to be in Orlando, Florida in September rather than California. These events bring together like-minded pros across the industry, academia, government for a blend of engaging plenary sessions. There are in-depth Forum 360 programming, robust technical programming, and networking opportunities. AIAA's members help make the world safer, more connected, more accessible, and more prosperous. So join them and get a lot more information at AIAA.org. So that brings me to our show today, and I am very pleased, in fact, more than pleased, to bring back to the show good friend and a previous space show guest, Dr. Sean Casey. He is the co-founder and managing director of the Silicon Valley Space Center, which is a business accelerator for new space entrepreneurs in the Silicon Valley. He's a member of the Suborbital Applications Research Group of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation and has over two decades of experience as an airborne astronomer. And his work has been recognized as an example of NASA's goal for more efficient and cost-effective methodology to do instrument design and construction. His full bio is on the website with his picture. I urge you to check it out, read about him. But we're going to talk about him and with him rather than just read about him. So, Sean, welcome back to the Space Show. It's really nice to have you back on board.
Great. Thank you very much, David. I know it's been a while since we've connected, but I welcome the opportunity to speak to you and your listeners about things that are happening in or around Silicon Valley and elsewhere.
So start out, because the show has grown a lot, and a lot of people may not even know what the Silicon Valley Space Center is. We do get emails from listeners who are participants in it from time to time, and if the traffic wasn't so bad, I'd be a regular participant in it. But, you know, I can't stomach the drive anymore. So give us sort of an idea, a rough sketch of what it is for all the new listeners and people not familiar with it.
Sure. We function as a incubator and accelerator for new space companies under several verticals. We've done this for a number of years under, I say, hardware, software, and wetware. We got our start some time ago working on the open source lunar effort, and I believe that phone call was on one of your earlier calls. And so, you know, we've really been looking at the opportunities in commercial spaceflight, which today, you know, 2015, 16, and 17 have just been incredible banner years for this industry, and perhaps, you know, outpaced our expectations for growth. But we work with scientists and engineers that are in the conceptual stages of a startup plan, and then go work them through the, you know, Steve Blank's lean startup methodology in order to, you know, formulate a concept which is suitable for angel and venture capital investment. You know, in talking to entrepreneurs, there's a choice between lifestyle businesses and investment businesses, and not all startup ideas fall under that VC category. So we try and work with early stage companies, and I'll talk some about that later on. It's been a great experience, and certainly an educational one. We also do tech talks here in the Bay Area. We've tried to keep our finger on the pulse of the industry. Early on, when we started our tech talk series, we had the co-founders of Planet Labs when they were still at NASA talking about their PhoneSat program. We also had Peter Plotzer when he was just getting started with RGSat, the list goes on with groups like Ryan Holmes from Space VR and even Boyer DeWitt from Lunar Station. So, you know, since my background is in science and engineering, combined with business, I find it enjoyable to work with early stage companies and try and shape their concepts so that it will get traction in the marketplace.
Do you only work with Bay Area, Northern California companies, or if someone in Vermont had a startup that they wanted to deal with, are you able to work with someone, say, across the country?
Yeah, the MIT group, Blair DeWitt, is an example of that. Blair DeWitt is, in Boston. He's a graduate of the Sloan School out at MIT. His co-founders are out at MIT. This next weekend, they're doing what's called the New Space Age Conference out at MIT. If people haven't heard about it, I suggest they look it up. But, we're really just looking for good ideas wherever they come from. And, our model is one of virtual acceleration. So we generally, I find that it's good to get together with people for face-to-face meetings to get started, but then, you can do a fair amount of work over the phone and, through Google Hangouts and so forth.
Do people interested in this have to be a member of the Silicon Valley space group, or how do they find out about it? Can they subscribe to it? Give us some logistics.
Sure. The tech talks we offer are usually, on Eventbrite, and you sort of pay the price. If you're a member of the Silicon Valley Space Center, you get access to our email announcements for our tech talks. We're looking forward to getting our tech talks online, and then the online version of those talks would be available to Silicon Valley Space Center members. And if you're a member, you also get free admission to our tech talk series. In working with entrepreneurs, membership is not important, but we usually work for an equity share in the company, so that we're all pushing in the same direction, where that equity is vested over a period of time based on our working with the company over a 6 to 12 month period.
What's the website of your group?
It's SiliconValleySpaceCenter.org.
That's easy to remember.
one big word, SiliconValleySpaceCenter.org. I believe we also have SVSC.org. And if people are interested in reaching the organization, they can just type in newspace@SiliconValleySpaceCenter.org. That goes to a number of people on our team. And if you want to reach me, I'm just Sean.Casey@SiliconValleySpaceCenter.org.
And you're expanding throughout the Bay Area, right?
Well, I try and get around so that My home office is here in San Jose. We have our Tech Talk series we do at Hacker Dojo. We also have other locations. We have a location in Menlo Park where earlier, or towards the end of last year, we had the UK Innovate Group come to Silicon Valley. We hosted about 10 companies from the UK pitching in front of Silicon Valley investors, and then we also had a networking event that was held at Boot Up in Menlo Park, which is the old Willow Garage location, and we're working on a San Francisco location for our Tech Talks, and then we generally have a partnership with a group called Sandbox Suites that's here in the Bay Area, and they offer office space in Palo Alto, San Francisco, and Berkeley. And so Sandbox Suites allows us to travel the Bay Area and have office and meeting locations.
What are some of the other programs and events you're working on other than the Silicon Valley Space Center?
Well, one of the big efforts that we're working on, which I'd like to tell you about later on during the call, is our New York Center for Space Entrepreneurship. And over the last number of years, it's become obvious that space is getting pushed from the federal level down to the state level. And in my mind, each state has a decision as to, are they going to play in this new space area? Out in California, we currently have legislation for the California Space Alliance, which was operational several years ago, David, as you probably know. But I just seen an email a while ago from Sacramento that legislation has been reintroduced to energize that organization.
Yeah, I was a member. I used to go to all their events in Sacramento to lobby for space policy. That helped make me even more cynical about government than I already was.
It's a double-edged sword. But I think if you look at places like Florida, I think Florida has been extremely successful with their Space Florida effort, and then also with the Florida Space Institute, two organizations that are funded out of Tallahassee. There's been discussions about Texas. Texas has a lot of space activity between Brownsville, Houston, Austin, and Midland. Down at Brownsville is, of course, the site of the new SpaceX, and I'm kind of spacing on the university group that's down there, but Brownsville is working on how they should be the new space city. There's also Spacecom, which is the Houston effort for engaging new space communities, and as we saw several years ago, the announcement of Midland, Texas, securing the company X-Corps and getting them to move from California down in Mojave to Midland, Texas. And so the New York Center for Space Entrepreneurship, in my mind, is a response to what is how can New York garner their intellectual resources and be a significant player in the new space industry. Four most populous states in the union, California, Texas, Florida, and New York. New York needs to weigh in on this opportunity, which in my mind is not a flash in the pan of commercial space. It's important for the next decade, but pretty much commercial space and entrepreneurial space is going to be important for the remainder of the 21st century. And your ad for Celestis and Moon Express and Bob Richards and his Moon Express team is going to make that a pioneering commercial flight to the moon. With Rocket Lab out of New Zealand, it's going to be tremendously exciting. And in my mind, in the next couple of decades, the moon is in the crosshairs of the new space industry, where it's just pretty clear that Mars is in the crosshairs for the 21st century.
The Mars people won't like hearing that from you, Sean.
Well, I just I was at Spacecom, and everyone's like, low Earth orbit, moon, asteroids, Mars, and with Blair DeWitt and the Moonwatcher program, my bet is that we're going to see a lot of activity happening on the moon. And, you know, David, I think you've got your finger on the pulse of the industry for what people are thinking about. And my sense is that there are ideas bubbling up out of Washington, D.C. on how the moon can figure into a strategic roadmap for our continued expansion into the solar system.
Yeah, I'm certainly getting that sense on the policy side, although there is no real policy in place yet. There's not even a NASA administrator yet. But on the advocate side, the people, for example, who listen to the show, this moon versus Mars debate, which is just going to go on in perpetuity, I guess, it's still pretty evenly split between going to Mars and screw the moon, and or going to the moon and using the moon as a stepping stone to Mars, or whatever. I think there would be universal support if we had a space program that was funded enough to do both, and to do both basically simultaneously, because the Sophie's Choice, one or the other, is pretty detrimental across the board, but we don't live in that kind of a world right now. But I do think on policy side, you're right. There seems to be an indication that we're going to have a lunar resurgence. We're waiting to see what it is, right?
Right. I think that lunar resurgence is not like flags and footprints.
No, I agree with you.
Of the Apollo era.
And I think it also includes some cislunar development. In fact, for several months, and this has picked up a little bit, I've been talking on the show, and more people seem to be agreeing with it. Paul Sudas certainly agreed with it last Sunday with some specifics. But if we ever do see Congress pass an infrastructure bill, and, you know, that's a big, big if, given our Congress, there is absolutely no reason why there should not be a segment of that going to vital national security support for developing space infrastructure, which would both help the nation and help the commercial space sector. And why shouldn't a segment of that infrastructure go into helping with much-needed infrastructure to support space and all sorts of aspects on national security space as well as commercial space? Now, I don't know if that's going to catch on fire. It certainly has within the space cadet community. But getting it into the broader picture of how they make policy, that of course, as you know, is a different story.
Well, I think today we're well positioned with a number of space companies that are interested in going back to the moon.
They got a lobby for it, boy. If they're going to do an infrastructure bill, they got a lobby for something along the lines of supporting cislunar or cyber or something for national security and commercial space infrastructure.
I couldn't agree, but I think that you know, today we've got a number of commercial companies that are out there. I mean, I think that you know, in the aerospace sector, you've got, you know, the four billionaires that are focused on space, which are, you know, Paul Allen and the Vulcan program, Jeff Bezos and Blue, of course Elon Musk and SpaceX, and Richard Branson. And Virgin, all focused on one topic, which is reusability.
By the way, did you see all the press coming out today all over the place, including the WAPO, about Bezos' manifesto plan? I think it's a 7-page white paper on going back to the moon.
Yep.
And it's all over the Internet, but since he owns the Washington Post, they're probably printing most of it, and they've got links to his actual 7-page plan. And he's really going after it with the new administration to put it into play.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think we could view the moon as a commercial stepping stone to Mars. I mean, people will think that there are, you know, nationalistic objectives in working on the moon. But as Paul Sudas, you know, knows in great detail, there are tremendous resources that that the moon has that we need to understand how to harvest and how to use for the benefit of, you know, I would say, you know, humanity, even if there are those things that filter back to life on planet Earth. The moon is an important stepping stone where we've been there. We've done all five stages of what is a typical NASA program between flyby, orbit, land, rove, sample return. That, you know, for anything that you're going to go visit, you have to do all those. On the asteroids, on the other hand, you've done flyby and orbit. You know, for Pluto, with Alan Stern and the New Horizons missions, we've done a flyby. But all those five stages of flyby, orbit, land, rove, sample return are things that we've demonstrated on the moon. And we brought back hundreds of kilograms of material. But when you talk to the mining community, we really don't know everything that there is to know about the moon for commercial activities. And these first companies that are Moon Express, Astrobotic, even groups like Space IL, it's amazing that the Israeli team has morphed into what is a national project to do their lunar lander. We've got Team Indius out of India. I think the GLXP effort has been very successful in garnering the support of dispersed groups to focus on an objective on the moon. And I see that, you know, pretty much within this decade, you know, hopefully in the next couple of years, we're going to have a tremendous excitement by the GLXP teams in landing, and then continued emphasis on the moon through Bigelow's discussion of inflatable habitats on the moon, Jeff Bezos's plan, and other groups like Maiden Space that are talking about in situ resource utilization. And I've talked to a number of other groups, along similar lines. So the Moonwatcher effort that Blair DeWitt is heading up out of MIT is really, it's got sort of two parts of the program. One is a B2C play, which is to give everybody kind of routine access to the moon through imaging satellites in low Earth orbit, and then later on in lunar orbits, and then a B2B play of serving that community that's going forward to capitalize on lunar resources.
Yeah, you actually had the first email question was from Jerry in Boulder, wanting you to explain what the Moonwatcher program was. So sure. I'm glad you're talking about that. So it's both business to consumers and business to business plan. And where can we find out about it?
Moonwatcher is actually the company that's run by Blair DeWitt. It's called Lunar Station, and I believe it's lunarstation.com is the website. But also, if you go to Kickstarter, we're currently doing a Kickstarter program for Moonwatcher. The satellite itself is built with engineers out of MIT. They have a partnership with Draper Lab to help on technology logistics associated with the program. But then, you know, its initial goal is to provide 24/7 video access from low Earth orbit of the moon. And, you know, I think it's much like other websites like SLU.com and remote ground-based observatories. Moonwatcher is going to be one of the first space-based observatories that will be available to the community. And of course, the advantage of being in low Earth orbit for lunar observations is that A, you're above the effects of seeing from the ground, so that your telescope is diffraction limited in space, and then B, you're above inclement weather, right, which has always affected ground-based astronomy. And I think there have been a number of exciting astronomical programs that are garnering the technologies of the small sat communities. Sarah Seeger has her exoplanet detection satellite. There are also gamma ray facilities being built out at Goddard on the SmallSat program. And I think that small satellites, I was just at the SmallSat symposium here at the Computer History Museum, put out by small sat magazine, and sitting on the technology panel, everything that's a technology related to small satellites is up for grabs and demonstration in low Earth orbit, whether it's computing infrastructure, communications infrastructure, batteries, solar panels, pointing, docking, all of that stuff is going to get played out in this small sat sector, where I think the commercial sector has kind of eclipsed what government is going to do, and it's on its sort of own track. And Moonwatcher is leveraging those commercial technologies and is going to provide this observational facility for the broad community. And, you know, we've had discussions with educators, and, you know, I mean, it's been a long time since I was in grade school, but, you know, phases of the moon are part of understand, you know, part of the educational curriculum. You know, the fact that the moon orbits the Earth and has different phases with respect to the sun, and to understand that geometry, you can actually cover lunar observations 24/7 with Moonwatcher, and I suspect, like with anything, where you're just constantly watching, collecting data on an object, you're going to see transient events that otherwise you would miss from just snapshots here and there. So the first part of the program is to put in a small constellation of satellites in LEO for just continuous observations of the moon, and then as the program grows, to put in a constellation in a lunar orbit that I think will give everyone sort of eye in the sky for what's happening in this growing lunar renaissance that we're just starting to see today in 2017. But as you and I have talked about it, I mean, we've kind of looked at this for, since 2010, and it's been pretty much a decade in coming, but it seems like it's really in the news with both SpaceX and Bezos and, discussions in Washington.
On the Moonwatcher program, are people going to be able to use a telescope to view whatever they want on the moon? How does that actually work?
Well, I think it's along the line of a lunar survey, so that we'll be able to update imaging for activities, and then we're working out the details as to what the communication link is. One of the things that you see in the industry is that we're moving very quickly on infrastructure. Right now, there are a number of ground station companies that are offering, that are coming online within the last couple of years, that are serving the small sat community, and there are even those companies that are working on optical communications. For the MIT group, they're one of the leaders in optical communication technologies, and we're hoping that our Moonwatcher satellites will be able to benefit from those technologies to provide a live video stream from a lunar orbit. The initial, I think, is the LRO mission with an optical communication site in Greenbelt, Maryland, demonstrated the ability to stream data. I think they ran out of Netflix movies to stream from their ground. I mean, I hope I don't get in trouble on that. But, you know, if you're streaming movies directly from the Earth to the moon and back, they use that as a way of doing quality control on their transmission. And so I think that has already been demonstrated, but now it's time to put it into practice. And so, as Wayne Gretzky says, you don't skate to where the puck is; you skate to where the puck's going to be. And Moonwatcher is positioned itself for this lunar renaissance, and then the technologies that we're talking about are those that have sort of already flown in space, are already part of the CubeSat community, plus taking advantage of the technologies that we anticipate to be in place come 2018 and beyond.
Jack is in Boulder, Colorado, and he said, are you seeing the start or the beginning of any potential commercial movements for humans to the moon?
Well, I think that's a very interesting issue. Certainly, the SpaceX announcement that came out earlier this week, I got a phone call from actually an email from ABC News saying, "Hey, could we chat with you about the SpaceX announcement, which is essentially an Apollo 8 mission?"
Apollo 8.
Apollo 8 mission.
It's a different kind of orbit to the moon, but other than that, it's
right. But,
same idea.
You know,
same
with
idea.
If you look at you know, NASA's program, we had the Apollo 1 flyer, and then the real manned flight for Apollo was Apollo 7, and that put astronauts in orbit. And then the subsequent mission from Apollo 7 was Apollo 8, which was a cislunar.
That was a Christmas Eve flight around the moon.
Right, and that was, you know, a phenomenal achievement. And so we're looking at SpaceX doing something of the same thing, you know, basically on the same fast track for manned spaceflight. SpaceX is going to do their manned mission to the ISS, manned mission to low Earth orbit, and then based on, you know, space tourism, commercial demand, they're in a position to do a cislunar mission, which was revolutionary in the 60s. And we got phenomenal images, which is, you know, some of the most stark, but, humbling of images of the Earth silhouetted, against a very black background, which, you know, emphasized at that time during the 60s how, you know, there really aren't borders and walls, and that we are, as humanity, you know, together, yet at the same time very much alone in our solar system. So I think it gave everyone a better appreciation for who we are as a species and the importance of our accomplishments and what we can do if we put our minds to tasks that are constructive and positive.
What about humans to the surface of the moon? Are you seeing anything on that front?
Well, a great effort is led by Alan Stern at Golden Spike, which, you know, is, if there's anybody that's able to do Apollo 18, 19, and 20, it would be Alan Stern, as literally a force of nature, and, you know, with his demonstrated success on the New Horizons mission to send the first flyby probe to Pluto. And, you know, the ongoing debate of, is Pluto a planet? Is it a dwarf planet? You know, astronomers are going to be, you know, discussing Pluto's place in the solar system. But Golden Spike is geared toward follow-on manned exploration. And as a commercial company, I'm sure there are those government programs. But, you know, that's manned exploration is a high-dollar program, but it's essential. Steve Squires gave a talk to one of the committees about manned spaceflight. What's the name from the guy at Lockheed? But Steve Squires, who was head of the two solar-powered Mars rovers, commented in that in his presentation, which is available online from YouTube, that Harrison Schmitt, who was the only geologist to land on the moon in Apollo 17 and one of the last missions, accomplished more during a short stay on the moon than they had accomplished for several years of robotic exploration of Mars. And that's Steve Squire, who's PI of that mission. I was surprised for Steve Squires to say that, and, you know, you can go to YouTube and dig up that presentation. But it speaks to the value of manned exploration, and I think you see that in places like nanotech labs around the country and in operations on the International Space Station. And, you know, as Steve said, for just exploration of the moon, there's something about the trained, Harrison Schmidt is just not anybody, but he's a trained geologist and researcher. And so when you see something in nature, since you've been studying natural phenomena in your entire career, you have a very good insight. And, you know, we're looking at a time where there's a balance between AI and robotics and man's, you know, manned activities anywhere. I mean, in the factory floor all the way up to the International Space Station. And I believe that all those technologies, AI and robotics, serve as a force multiplier for manned exploration. And that as we go forward, it's going to be a combination of the two. But we may be at a crossroads where robotic exploration, because it has such a large economy and scale, when you look at the technology that Google and others are using in the robotic self-driving cars, you know, those technologies are going to have an impact on space flight. And whether we see robots, you know, sentient robots exploring the moon, or you know, our 2001 view of the future with our astronaut corps serving as the front line for exploration is TBD. But recognizing true opportunities, things that are out of the box, things that are unexpected, is probably always going to fall to manned exploration. But we shall see. As they say, you know, AI and robotics is on an exponential curve.
Rex sent in a note from Southern California. I think it's appropriate for the show, although it might be as part of an email exchange I've been having with Rex over a few days. But he says the SpaceX mission to circle the moon would help set the tune for lunar activity for decades to come. And I think that is absolutely right.
Right. Yeah. And the fact that you've got both Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos kind of pushing in the same direction. And if you want to say, why is it different this time? And that's because you've got individuals that can command tremendous capital resources to apply this to a problem that's beyond our terrestrial concerns.
Well, you also have different technology and different rockets available and cost structures that are happening. So it's not the same world as it was just a few years ago.
Right. Not at all. So our getting back to our Moon Watcher program, this is a Kickstarter that's ongoing. We've learned a lot about the demographics for the moon. It turns out that you know, interest in the moon is, you know, spans generations. It also, you know, there are differences in gender. Usually, younger, you know, the female portion of our population is very interested in lunar activities. I mean, we see that there's a lot of women that are going into science and engineering. There are a lot of programs that encourage that kind of growth and participation. And we also see that there are those people, you know, like myself, that remember the Apollo era. And there are books, you know, The Orphans of Apollo, Jeff Namber and Rick Tumbleton are all part of that movement. And people have wondered, you know, why is it that we abandoned from the heyday of the Apollo era to drop the moon as a destination for humanity? And I'm thinking we're seeing a resurgence of that today. And with Moon Watcher, our bet is that it's going to continue to be an important asset and location and destination for commercial space activities and over the next couple of decades.
Sean, we're almost exactly at the midway point, so I'm going to pause us here. That seldom happens on the space show. Listeners, we're going to take our 3-minute intermission with Dr. Sean Casey, and we'll be back with more commercial space activity news, lunar activity, and if you can give us a call. I know this is Friday, so that may be challenging for many of you. It is 1-866-687 7223. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com and commenting on our blog, as I explained earlier. And we'll take more of your comments and questions in the second segment of today's program. Back again in about 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Friday Space Show program. Our guest is Dr. Sean Casey. You can call us, and we do want your calls, 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Three sponsors are making this segment possible. So there is the Integrated Space Plan, which is a detailed 100-year forecast of our future in space. The plan includes Earth-to-orbit and reusable in-space transportation. It also depicts developments of the Moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt and space settlements. Their website, where you can see it all, is thespaceplan, that's all one word, .com. While viewing the plan online, you can click on any of its 500 elements for more info. The Integrated Space Plan has a poster. I have one. It's huge, full color, and available on their website, and it's guaranteed to get you more excited about our future in space. Be sure to visit thespaceplan.com. They are rolling out a new one, everybody, which is going to be really cool. For those of you going to ISDC later in May, you can attend the rollout. So we'll have more about that as we get closer to ISDC. The Space Foundation is a sponsor, and their big, really cool event is just around the corner. This is the 33rd Space Symposium. Engage with global leaders and decision makers at the 33rd Space Symposium, April 3rd through the 6th in Colorado Springs. Their website is spacesymposium.org. Remember, I am moderating a panel, I think, on the last day of all NASA Center directors, and maybe if there's a new administrator by then, the administrator will join in. If you're going to be there and you want to meet, email me. I'll give you my cell phone number, and we can set up a meeting via text messaging. I'm understanding that thousands of people show up at this event. So just to try to say, meet me over there in the corner by the X, that's not going to work. So we'll set something up via text message, and I look forward to meeting you. And our final sponsor for this segment is Orbital ATK. They are a global leader in aerospace and defense technology. They are known as the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. Sean, tell us something more about the New York Center for Space Entrepreneurship. Is it actually in New York City? Is it upstate New York at Albany, where the capital is? Give us something more about it.
Yeah, sure. This is an effort that we started over the last year that was motivated, Kaki Rodway, who I think people may know from her work on X-Corps. We did an event some time ago out here in the Bay Area on citizen astronauts and citizen science that was very successful with Ed Wright. Kaki was there representing X-Corps. Kaki has since moved on to from Mojave to New York, and so I was very interested. I gave a talk some time ago in my travels when I was in D.C. up in New York to talk to the New York space entrepreneurial community, and I, as a New Yorker, been very intrigued by what is New York doing in the new space sector. So, in collaboration with Sidney Nakahodo and Joseph Fargnoli, who are New Yorkers. Sidney is at Columbia and is part of the policy group at Columbia University, and Joe runs the writer group up in Rochester. We put our heads together and created the New York Center for Space Entrepreneurship, and it's in response to perhaps what the success that I see down in Florida between Space Florida and the Florida Space Institute, to create an entity which is focused on developing space industry in the state of New York, while at the same time reaching out to universities. New York has a great educational base upon which to build such an organization. It includes Columbia and Cornell. We have partnerships with both of those, with researchers in both of those universities for our effort. As a matter of fact, Mason Peck, who was the former NASA CTO, is on our board. And Sabi Marka from Columbia, who was just recently got an award for gravitational wave physics as part of the physics department at Columbia, is also part of our team. And we're looking to organize the universities in the New York area. That includes Rochester Institute of Technology. I'm going up there next week to give a talk. There's the SUNY and SUNY systems. We've also had discussions with Fordham University in the city. And our initial plans are for a facility in New York, in the city, with Roosevelt Island. That our discussions with Cornell are to leverage the technology program that they're instituting in New York City. New York City needs to be more about more than just finance, but we're looking to leverage that. I think you might say, here I am in Silicon Valley. What am I doing way out on the East Coast? But I see that there's an important connection between New York and Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley has early stage venture capital money, whereas New York is, the home and always has been for institutional investors. So we feel that it's not only important to connect the New York universities under a united program for commercial space, but then also to work with the institutional investment firms within the New York community. And one of our partners for NICE, as we call it, New York Center for Space Entrepreneurship, NICE, and NYCSE, is SSPI, the Society of Satellite Professionals International, which has its home in New York, but has a large international reach. So Lou Zaccarella, we just had a phone call today, and Lou's on the line, and I believe people will see Lou down at the Satellite 2017 conference. There's a startup pitch event that they're doing that features like a dozen companies. B-Space is part of that group, a number of others. URSA, which is a New York company, I believe, is going down there. And, you know, I feel that it's important to have that connection across the country. It's not just New York, but it's New York, Silicon Valley. It's New York, Silicon Valley, Florida, Texas, Colorado. I feel that entrepreneurship is local. Not everybody wants to pack their bags and come to Silicon Valley, but that each state has a responsibility to say, what are they going to do for space entrepreneurs? A great example is Kentucky. Chris Kitts is the head of Kentucky Space, and they've done a great job in you know, supporting Space Tango and growing that Kentucky community. So Bob Twiggs is down there at Morehead State University, and they do just a great job of engaging new space companies within that Kentucky community and getting them to the ISS and beyond. So I look at the GDP around the country. You've got California, which is number one at about $2 trillion. Vermont is number 50 at 1/100th of that level. And all the states kind of map onto that. I was talking to somebody from Singapore that is doing space entrepreneurship down there. And Singapore has a GDP of about three times what Kentucky does. And so the fact that Kentucky has a space program, you might say, as I list GDPs around the country, I can map GDPs around the globe onto all those U.S. GDPs. And so the question is, what is Singapore doing in space? You know, we see Luxembourg. Luxembourg is supporting deep space industries and is weighing in on asteroid mining and, you know, the future of regulations for you know, in situ resource extraction throughout the solar system. As we mentioned before, SpaceIL, Israeli lunar lander team, and I think there's plenty of places where individual states can get involved in the growing new space industry and countries around the globe. So our New York effort is one focused on New York. It's focused on the Empire State. The Empire State strikes back, perhaps, is our logo, but then with a global reach, because New York has always been a global community. We have the UN there. It's always been a community that's been accepting of individuals from around the globe, and we hope that our New York Center for Space Entrepreneurship will serve as a very important East Coast hub for space startups.
Okay, and their website is, as you said, nycse.com, right?
Yes, and it's you can also reach us at spaceny.com.
Okay, so are you planning to have something like this in every state? Like there would be an Oklahoma space entrepreneur group and a Texas one and a Kansas one?
I think Texas is. I've been following the discussions down in Texas, and you might say, you know, how is that getting? How is it possible to get those different groups to work together? There's you know, Kentucky Space is an opportunity. There's also the group in Tennessee, which is focused on the Wayfarer organization that's focused on dual-use lunar technologies. So, you know, I'm focused on New York, and then I've also got some feelers out to Vermont. So, because I'd like to start at the top and, you know, work at the top and the bottom and then kind of sandwich everything in between. So, after we get our New York story going, I'm interested in seeing what we could work out for the Vermont community, just to put our flag in the ground down there.
Vermont is so close to New York, you'd think it would just be part of the New York group.
It might, but you know, we would welcome the opportunity. I mean, because in thinking about New York, we really think about the tri-state area. That includes, you know, New Jersey and Connecticut. It was interesting. Last year I went to the MIT meeting, the New Space Age conference. And what was great about that, it was not just MIT, but it also included participation from Yale. We have a group from Columbia, the Columbia Space Initiative, that's planning to attend this year, included RPI, Boston College, and in my mind was sort of an example of, you know, Massachusetts coming together, even though you've got Yale and Columbia participating. But it was really sort of a student group effort happening at MIT, but included a wide variety of other universities. You know, in the Boston area, you've got the Mass Challenge, and the Mass Challenge has a close working relationship with the guys at CASIS. So I think Massachusetts probably has its own effort. Utah, I just saw a little while ago that there is a space business plan competition happening within the state of Utah. I don't have the details about it, but to me that was an important another important data point for how states are responding. Texas, you know, can you get Brownsville and Houston and Austin to all work together? They all seem to be sort of city states. California is its own challenge. I've, in working with Sacramento, tried to emphasize that Northern California is an aerospace hub, right? We've got Planet here, we've got Spire, we've got Space No, we've got, Orbital Insights. We've got a number of very exciting new space companies, and so not all the action is happening down in Southern California, which is where our traditional aerospace hub. So I've always tried to move the needle a little bit north, and it will be interesting to see what happens with our California Space Alliance and how that proceeds through the legislature and what kind of resources California is able to cut loose. Now, maybe that we've had this torrential rain for the early part of 2017. Sacramento's focus will no longer be on water, but on some other things.
That's exactly right. So who knows? So you have a question, email Helen in Seattle, that says, are you getting any financial or at least we love you support from NASA?
As a former NASA person, I think the love from NASA is an interesting. I'll just say an interesting story. I think NASA, all the NASA centers have areas of responsibility around the country. So, for the New York area, for instance, NASA Goddard is the center that caters to the New York area. I think NASA is struggling with what their future direction is going to be. I do think that NASA has been very supportive of the commercial space industry, and if you look at companies like Made in Space, that their ability to work with a very small startup has been exemplary in the Made in Space example. I always feel that if you're a small company, if you know, NASA's always happy to partner with Google, to partner with large aerospace firms, to partner with GM and what have you. But there's the perception that if the revenues of the company are not comparable to something like what the NASA budget is, then it's not really a partnership, but is viewed as a subcontractor relationship. For NASA to partner with Moon Express, for instance, you'd like to see NASA buying services from Moon Express. Currently, under the NASA Flight Opportunities Program, NASA buys flights from Virgin Galactic, from Blue Origin, also from Up Aerospace, and companies like Worldview, the ballooning group down in Arizona. I think NASA needs to continue that program of buying services, not just from very large companies, but from some of these entrepreneurial companies. And that is already part of the discussion, but we'd like to see it even more so.
I think you have another note. Let's see if this come on, email. If this is coming in for you or for, boy, sometimes it just doesn't want.
Well, I mean, with that, David,
open.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I would say that all the NASA centers are slightly different, and here out in the Bay Area, NASA Ames, they have the Space Portal, which is a overall NASA facility, but the Space Portal has been very helpful in connecting the new space industry to the overall NASA ecosystem. Dan Rasky runs that effort, and Bruce Pittman is a fixture at many space events around the country, and that the two of them have done a really good job of connecting to the new space community. I would like to see that, the example that they've set is shared at other centers. I mean, Ames, because it's here in Silicon Valley, understands the early stage startup culture. At the SpaceCom event in Houston, we see Johnson doing a similar thing. The SpaceCom event down there has Johnson's participation, and is a great event to connect with the Johnson Space Flight Centers and some of the individuals that are looking at what the future of spaceflight will be and how new space companies can connect with that NASA plan. The same thing down in Kennedy, although Space Florida is separate from Kennedy per se, it still carves out part of the research park for their home, and they have lab space that's available to companies down there. And I think Space Florida serves as that impedance matching between new space companies and the established governmental aerospace firms in that area.
You have an email that is not signed, so I don't really know who's sending it, but they're email address begins with TIP, T-I-P, so maybe this is from someone who uses the name TIP, I don't know. But he says, Sean, do you think there's a chance the moon could offer resources that could be used to fuel rockets?
Well, it's, with the discovery of with the work of LCROSS, which was done out at NASA Ames, so Pete Warden had the initial concept of, gee, if we've got a booster, let's slam that booster into the moon and see what comes up. And so the LCROSS mission demonstrated the large water reserves that we already had an inkling of with Lunar Prospector that reside at the South Pole of the moon. It's certainly possible that future NASA missions will go, rather than where we've been before in the Apollo days, go to this South Pole region where data suggests there are large water reserves, and water can be broken down into its fundamental components of hydrogen and oxygen that can then be used as fuels for further exploration of the solar system. Fuels that are available from the moon could be stored in fuel depots, and I think there's a good deal of discussion about the development of fuel depots that would serve a growing community. So much like around here, where there are gas stations at every corner, and I haven't been following the Tesla story, but I was just driving up from Southern California, and lo and behold, there's tons of Tesla charging stations. And so a fuel depot serves that same kind of function. And rather than having to take that fuel and take it from their surface to low Earth orbit and beyond. Perhaps we could generate that fuel on from bodies that have less of a work function in order to get to orbit. But I think the moon, as you say, offers us water resources. It offers us mineral resources and, you know, exotic components like helium-3 that have accumulated over the eons from solar winds. But, you know, how you're able to actually use that helium-3 in a reactor is you know, technology of the future.
You have another email from a listener. So Wayne is in Houston that you've been talking about a little bit. And Wayne said, to me, a real commercial market exists when you have commercial companies that you can buy some stock or equity in the company. So we can do that with traditional aerospace like Boeing and Orbital ATK and others. But what are the opportunities to make an investment in stock or equity in any of the entrepreneurial startup or new generation of commercial companies? They're all private. There's not much real information known about them because they are private. And where are the stock opportunities? Are any of them planned for IPOs? Do you know anything about the opportunities expanding into the commercial market for investors to consider?
Mm-hmm. There are some companies that have done reverse IPOs. So, for instance, Earthcast was one of those that it acquired a public company, and therefore it had a publicly, you know, it has a publicly
bought
traded,
into it, yeah,
right, a publicly traded stock. These days, the opportunities for investment is on early stage companies. If you go to the Satellite 2017, I think this Tuesday, there'll be a number of early stage companies that are going to be presenting at the Satellite 2017 event. And early stage companies are the kinds of things that angel investors put money into, and there it's a question of due diligence and how do I recognize a good opportunity. Early stage investment is not for everybody in the country. And today, in the U.S., angel investors are typically called qualified investors, and that means that A, you've got, if you're unmarried, you have over $200,000 a year in income. If you're married, your combined income has to be $300,000. I believe that's the case. Or you can have $1 million in assets. That doesn't include your home. So, you know, out here it's not hard to have $1 million in asset on a home. But the amount of that to be a qualified investor is it's going to exclude what your home investment is. And there are a number of angel groups. The Houston Angel Network. We have Sandhill Angels out here. If you're in Houston, I would suggest Nathan Singh from the Houston Angel Network. I did a SpaceCom event with Nathan last year, and he gave a really nice presentation of how angel investing works. And I'm sure, David, that you've had angel investment groups on your calls previously.
Right.
Right, but that's those are early stage investments, and that's, you know, if you want to put $25,000 to $50,000 to $100,000 to work, and that can actually show big returns or big losses. An interesting aspect of this, aside from IPO, is the growing crowdfunding effort. I mean, I mentioned that Moonwatcher is doing its Kickstarter, and I view that there are sort of two different, you know, people sometimes confuse, you know, crowdfunding like the Kickstarter variety, which is one of market validation. You know, the Pebble Watch was a great example of that. Here's a product. It's out there. How can I generate pre-sales of that product without actually having it on the shelf? So I can go to a Kickstarter and then get the word out and see how people respond to that product. Well, there's also, in the startup realm, when you're talking about your company, you're not necessarily selling your product to investors, you're selling your company to investors. And equity crowdfunding is a very interesting topic, which because of recent governmental regulations, equity crowdfunding is not just for accredited investors, those that fit the categories that I just mentioned, but for unaccredited investors. And actually, with any startup, you can have, I believe it's up to 35 unaccredited investors. So if you're starting a company and doing a friends and family round, most likely those are unaccredited investors, and so you can have a certain number of unaccredited investors. But within equity crowdfunding, I believe it's open to unqualified and qualified investors, and that anybody can invest, where anybody is unqualified or qualified investors, anyone can invest up to $2,000, up to $100,000 a year, and that companies, last I checked, under equity crowdfunding, could pull in $1 to $2 million during any 12-month period. And there are a couple of good ones. I just was on the phone to a group called Microvesting that's out of Texas, but WeFunder is a Y Combinator company that's raised several $1 million from hundreds of investors themselves on their own WeFunder platform, and that WeFunder under equity crowdfunding has amounted to 80% of what is like the $13 million that was raised in 2016 over 55 campaigns. So I think in 2017 and beyond, we're going to see the rise of this equity crowdfunding platforms. And WeFunder is one, StartEngine is another, NextSeed is another, EquityNet. Jay Whitner from the Space Finance Group down in Florida and I have been having discussions about how the space industry can get involved in raising money. It's just another vehicle for raising funds for your company. And I might say that equity crowdfunding is kind of like a gigantic friends and family round. I mean, at the $1 to $2 million level. I mean, you're not expecting your friends and family to be passive investors, active versus passive investors. So an active investor is one, hi, I'm putting my money in the company and let me help you guys grow your company. A passive investor is, hey, let me just put my money in the company and why don't you go have
a good time, right?
Yeah, why don't you guys have at it. And Sunil from Bessemer said that, just during the Small Sat Symposium, that both passive and active investors are valuable investors to have. And it depends upon the sentiment of the investor. And I can tell you that a startup company, it's good to get smart investor money or active investor money, because you're navigating terrain. And, if you're just following your own sense of the market, that can be good, but it's good to have some advisors that you can bounce ideas off of and get another opinion about things. And it's good to bring different eyeballs to bear on the same problem and come up with unique solutions.
Do you see any great breakthroughs in commercial space for 2017? Are you looking forward to like a Netscape moment or anything like that?
That Netscape moment. I think the Netscape moment is a couple of things. One is the success of the GLXP groups. I think that is going to get a tremendous amount of press. Number two is the return of U.S. astronauts to aboard U.S. vehicles. So SpaceX and Boeing are both in that competition to deliver, to provide manned spaceflight services to NASA. I think that's going to be a big watershed moment. And of a similar ilk is human spaceflight the word Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin. Virgin, as we know, had a big setback with the demise of their Spaceship Two vehicle. They're now on the road to recovery. I was just down at Spaceport America as part of the Suborbital Applications Research Group for the Commercial Space Flight Federation. Every year, that group does an on-site visit somewhere. We were up at Blue not that long ago. We were down in Orlando. This year, we're down at Spaceport America. And Virgin is going to give a great experience to, I believe, the 800 people that have purchased tickets for Spaceship Two. I tend to have more of a populist leaning on this, and I believe that space flight really needs to be for everybody. High dollar tickets are great, but then it also plays into the role of companies in manned space flight. And another important inflection point here will be when NASA permits researchers to fly on vehicles like Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin. Today, NASA allows researchers, a wide variety of researchers, to participate in zero-G flights, parabolic flights that were done under the Flight Opportunities Program. The same kind of permission will be required for researchers to participate on Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin. And at that level, you just have to have a proposal that's compelling, a research project which can be geared primarily to research, or something that's a combination of research and commercial endeavors. And the example I like to give, again, is the Maiden Space crowd, that if I bought a ticket for zero-G, I would buy one ticket. I'd probably do 15 parabolas, because that's what they say. You can do 15 without any air sickness medication to do over. People usually get, I'm one of them, so, 15 plus, and you're like, wait, I got to go to the back of the plane. But if you buy a ticket on zero-G, I can do 15 parabolas, and then I'm done. Maybe I do another flight with my friends, but I'm not going to do a lot of repeat flights. People do a holiday, and they're like, hey, I'm on to something else next time. But Maiden Space, to prove out their 3D printer technology, they did 400-plus parabolas on the zero-G vehicle in order to prove out their technology, in order for their engineers to get experience in a microgravity environment. And so, in my opinion, there's tremendous benefit from researchers flying on Virgin and Blue Origin and getting that hands-on experience. Again, as Steve Squire said, what matters is the researcher that's in the appropriate research environment. We don't have robots going into nanotech labs. We don't have robots going down to the Antarctic to do this work. I mean, researchers play an important role.
You have another question I want to work in before we're sure. Coming up on the end of the program. So this is Lonnie, Lonnie's in San Diego. And Lonnie says, earlier in the show, you did mention AI or artificial intelligence, but you really haven't talked about it. How does artificial intelligence support or detract from the development of commercial space? Is it an asset today? Is it an enabler, or is it possibly a detractor?
Oh, it's definitely an enabler. I mean, I think all of those technologies will enable us to do things that otherwise we couldn't do. If you look at great movies about the 1960s and the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis, imaging data that was used to determine whether Soviets were basing missiles in Cuba. All of that image analysis was done by people with looking glasses and individuals that were trained at looking at aircraft images to understand what does the Earth look like at a distance from a perspective that we haven't seen it previously. Today we've got companies like Planet Labs, which with their recent deployment of an enormous 80 plus satellite constellation in low Earth orbit, is geared to taking a daily snapshot of the planet There are major aerospace firms I've heard that have said, why would you want to image the planet on a daily basis? Well, you probably don't know what you're going to see. Once you start imaging the planet on a daily basis, you're looking at our world in a way that we've never seen it before. And that AI tools, big data and AI tools, are going to be essential to understanding that data, for doing change detection, for doing just the meshing of individual images together, for analyzing, for sorting through a big data problem. What you'd like to have is a very smart analytical engine that will sort through that and then present the high-level conclusions to decision makers, which are going to be, you know, people that can weigh all the different issues that are perhaps softer issues, which, you know, eventually AI will be able to, you know, take care of that. But, you know, is that, you know, forever, will that forever be a technology of the future, or is that something in the near term? So I think all of these technologies, which have large economies of scale, people that are doing big data are doing it not just for space, but for, you know, the Twitter feeds, the Facebook feeds, for medical data, all the large databases that we have, we're trying to apply deep learning and artificial intelligence engines to those problems. And space will just benefit from that. And the opportunity for entrepreneurs are to take technologies that have large economies of scale and apply those to the space sector. So if we look at Moon Express and the landing problem, or Space IL and landing vehicles on the moon, and Mass and Space Systems down in Mojave has been working this problem in partnership with JPL. You take some of those advanced, some of the AI technologies, and you give them to lander platforms, and they can navigate the unseen terrain. You know, if you look at, there's a, you know, the classic example is when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin were landing on the moon for Apollo 11. They took over manual control of the vehicle in order to position the lander in an area that they felt was suitable for what they wanted to accomplish, and avoid the big boulder fields that only became evident when they were there. So these AI technologies are going to help us, and it's a great opportunity for entrepreneurs that are engaged in these industries to apply them to the space sector and create new capabilities that augment what we currently have.
One more email question for you. I think we'll probably be out of time. Paul is in New York and says, usually with startup businesses, it's very quick to see the market get saturated, and then you start seeing casualties in the business before they sort out and you find out who might be the winners and who would be the losers. Are we close to seeing saturation in some of these entrepreneurial activities you've been talking about? Will we see a fallout and then some survivors?
I think we're already seeing mergers and acquisitions take place. Big news this week, I think it was this week or last week, was MDA acquiring Digital Globe. That gives MDA Earth observation capability. Earlier this year, we saw Planet Labs acquiring Parabella, which used to be called Skybox when it was at Google. Google
right.
acquired Skybox, which was a big win for the industry and a big win for investors. But then now Google, under its new Alphabet program, is figuring out what does it want to retain internally and what would it like to auction off. So Parabella / Skybox is now part of Planet Labs. Planet also acquired RapidEye. Earthcast acquired, another satellite company. We've seen software companies acquired by early stage space companies. So we're starting to see as we have more companies in play, you're going to see more M&A activities. I do believe that there are those investors that have put money down on earlier companies that are sort of waiting to see the infrastructure monetize the data that they're collecting. So what was an easy story, what was a story to sell in 2013, is not the same story to sell today. I do believe that there are investors that haven't put money in the market that are willing to place their bets on early stage startups, and we'll see how that plays out. If you do a word cloud of all the investors that have invested in what are like the top 100 companies that are listed by NewSpace Global, you see about 100 different investors, of which, let's say, 5 have done multiple investments. A whole bunch of those investors have just done one-of kinds of investments. So I think those same investors are probably looking for other opportunities in a growing commercial space sector. And NewSpace is not just, it's not additive manufacturing. This is, what is the economy going to look like for the rest of the 21st century? So I think we're going to see companies succeed. We're going to see companies fail. We're going to see companies merge. And that is part of a healthy ecosystem for startups, for well-established companies. And we're just going to see more of that. So you've got to be smart in doing a startup. You've got to figure out who the competition is, how you're going to differentiate your company from other companies. And, of course, you've got to figure out where's the market. You've got to retire market risk, and you've got to retire technology risk. And hopefully you don't have a company that has two, both market risk and technology risk.
Any closing comments, anything you'd like our listeners to hold on to or remember today?
The moon is going to be big in my mind, and our Moon Watcher program is part of that. That's kind of where we're putting our emphasis. But I would encourage anybody that's interested in entrepreneurial opportunities to reach out to Silicon Valley Space Center. If you're interested in the new space industry, always happy to chat with you and give you our perspective on things. And you can reach me at sean.casey@SiliconValleySpaceCenter.org.
Okay, Sean, you'll have to return much more frequently than what you have been doing, but it's great to catch up with you again and to hear all of this, and we'll look forward to talking to you later in the year for an updated report, okay?
Great. Thank you very much, David. I always enjoy speaking with you and your audience.
Likewise, and thank you. And listeners, Sunday, we're talking about the Explore Mars Humans to Mars big event, which is held every year with Chris Carberry. Everyone, thank you to Sean for being with us today, and thanks for my part as well for your participation in the show. So everybody have a great weekend. Keep it safe. Goodbye from Sean. Goodbye from David. And goodbye from The Space Show.